The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. 25 years ago, I did my only interview with a woman named Judith Tannenbaum. She spent 4 years during the 1980s teaching poetry at the maximum security prison, San Quentin, in California. And she had just published a book about it when we had her on the program in 2001. It's called Disguise as a Poem, My Years Teaching Poetry at San Quentin. It's the best of the Book Nook. How did you end up teaching poetry at San Quentin?
Well, it was circuitous, the path to get there. I had been doing a lot of poetry performance kind of work. Not like slam, not quite that performancey, but I had poems memorized that were my poems and poems by a lot of well-known poets, and I was doing that in a number of places. And I had a friend who was a teacher in the education department at one of the other California prisons at Tehachapi, and he asked me to come in and share that same performance with students there, with prisoners. And I did that. That was the first time I had ever walked inside a prison. And I was so moved by the response of the men there, that was a male prison, because they were responding to poems the same way I do, which is that it's not just as entertainment or as something aesthetic, but as something with the power, with the substance to actually nourish a person. And it was so, as I say, moving to kind of share that response to these poems that I loved so much, that when I came back, that prison was in Southern California, came back up to Northern California and started calling around. And I came to find out that in California, there is an arts and corrections program that is part of the Department of Corrections. And every state prison in California, even today, even as bad as times have gotten, still has an arts program. So I began doing more of these kind of guest appearances and then started teaching at San Quentin and then was asked to apply for a grant, which let me be there basically full time. So that was the one step led to the other kind of a story.
There are approximately 2 million Americans incarcerated in our country's prisons, and I think unless we have a loved one who is one of that number, they seem to be a faceless group, sort of an out of sight, out of mind situation. Now you actually saw the faces and heard the voices, and this clearly had an impact on you.
Yes. Well, what you're saying is very central to the reason for my writing this book. I have a lot of both emotional and intellectual reaction to just those facts that you were stating, how many people are incarcerated in this country, how it's becoming really an industry, all of those kinds of points. What I experienced was a human story. I got to know a few people, a few prisoners, very well over 4 years period of time, because San Quentin, when I was there, was a maximum security prison. So most of my students were serving some kind of a life sentence, which meant many things, but one of the things it meant for me as a teacher was that we were able to work together for 4 years. So most teachers don't get that kind of an experience, you know, that intense time and focus with one group of students. So I got to know these men as human beings, and I felt that that's what I had to share with the world outside, a world which, as you say, doesn't usually, unless somebody has somebody inside or for other reasons are very caught up in what's going on in prison, don't even necessarily think about these 2 million people as people. In fact, you know, one of my students, Codis, wrote a poem, and some of the lines in the poem I repeat throughout the book because it sums this up so well. This one stanza of his says, "Say, how you doing, outside world? Do you remember me? I'm that intricate part, missing from the whole, the the one you all decided to forget.
Mm.
And I felt it was kind of the gift I had been given, therefore kind of demanded, gave me an obligation to be able to share these people who were missing from the whole, so to speak.
My guest is Judith Tannenbaum. Her book is Disguised as a Poem, My Years Teaching Poetry at San Quentin. And she joins us by telephone from the San Francisco area. As I read about these men and read their poetry, I was very touched. And I think a lot of people in this country think that people in prisons don't have any sensitive side, that they're just almost like animals. And this is an image that I think is cultivated by the media.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And as I say, that was, you know, a lot of what felt like a human obligation in for me to write the book, to be able to show human beings as human beings, not as neither, you know, like heroes or romanticizing them, but nor as the beasts, as you say, as the media tends to portray people in prison, and as, you know, our politicians tend to take advantage, you know, count on that portrayal as a way to get votes and stuff. So, right. What I was interested in was presenting these men as complex human beings. And for me as a person, I mean, but I'm not writing their story. Of course, I can't, you know, write their story. But I was writing my story. So I was writing the story of this woman who had coming in from the outside, poet, middle class, and what I experienced. And a lot of what I experienced was because in getting to know these men who, as I say, were primarily serving life sentences, who had mostly come into prison in their very, very early 20s. The time I knew them, most of them had served maybe about 10 years on their sentence, and you know, were facing many more years in prison. These were men who had done very serious thinking about life. And so their own internal questions, I mean, whether articulated or not, about what does it mean to be a person and how do I do this? How do I do what's being asked of me, this sentence, this still keeping my humanity alive? I mean, every person in prison is going to have a different answer to that question, an answer that his lived life is going to, you know, be that answer. But I felt it was really a privilege in a human way to be able to observe people in that kind of a circumstance, and also knowing that they, you know, many of them had caused real harm to another person. Facing that complex, you know, humanity, what it is to be human, those questions.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
For the most part, Judith, you didn't know what these guys were in there for. All you knew was that they were human beings and that they were interested in poetry. And they made it very clear to you at one point that you could not speak for them.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I did know, in a way I knew, because they were serving life sentences, that at least they had been convicted of either a capital crime or kidnapping or something along. So even though I didn't know and didn't need to know their exact, what each person had specifically been convicted of, just because of their sentence, I knew that, you know, I knew generally speaking. But as you say, that I tried not to let go of that fact, because that was just one of the facts of who they were, and it seemed to me that it would be, you know, what would you say, like, what I call in the book false innocence, to pretend that hadn't happened, that wasn't part of their life experience too. But it wasn't the only fact of who they were. And as you say, as you just said really well, my job and my intention was to meet them in another aspect of who they were, this a person who was creative and sensitive and intelligent, and being able to and then being able to write poems from that space in themselves. You know, it's interesting that, because like One question I'm asked really frequently when in doing like bookstore readings and these phone interviews is, well, how did the men change? And at first, the question really surprised me because I think I don't think of change in that way, I guess. But then I could understand where the question was coming from in people, you know. But the way I see it is, we all have many possibilities inside of us, and some conditions give room for what's, let's say, worst in us, and other conditions give room for what's best in us. For these men in prison, most of the prison environment is predicated on just seeing the worst in them and assuming that they're going to always act from the worst of themselves and all of that. My class, the arts program, certain other places in the prison just give a physical and emotional space, actually, for another part of who they were as human beings. And so that was the part I got to see. I think the question that you were kind of implying in there, too, was when they were letting me know that that I couldn't speak for them, I was given that, you know, that message. I was told that frequently and appropriately, but it came about most, I guess, strongly. I was writing the poems that I began to write when I was at the prison were poems that were were actually from poems from a variety of points of view. I have always been interested in the notion of point of view and the technical tool of point of view. And prison is a world in which point of view is just so fascinating because you could have people, different people, each reporting the same event and each one doing their best to be honest, no one trying to lie, and get this complete variety of descriptions because people's, where they're standing from, their point of view is so different. So that was very fascinating to me. So I started to write poems that were in the voices of imagined people. Some of the poems were found poems, things that I heard said, but most of them were in the voices of imagined prisoners, guards, victims, like that. Because that was the only way I could kind of see to represent, to indicate the whole of that world. And I had a lot of rules for myself, and our rules were to never use anything anybody really had told me, or to pretend that I was speaking in any particular specific person's voice. They were poems of imagination. But when I read them to my students, some of my students were very upset, and we had actually a lot of talks about literature, about can somebody write about an experience not one's own. And that was something that was in the course of our whole 4 years of the class, just in terms of technical, a writing conversation. That was a very rich, interesting writing conversation because, as I just indicated, I have this interest in point of view and writing and persona. But my students primarily, you know, not across the board, but primarily felt that voice was supposed to be writing in one's own voice.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting conversation. Yeah.
You are listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, my 2001 interview with Judith Tannenbaum for her book Disguise as a Poem, my years teaching poetry at San Quentin on 91.3 WYSO, fact-based journalism in service of democracy. We'll bring you more of this conversation, but first this. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO, going back 25 years for this one, my only interview with a writer who taught poetry at a maximum security prison in California during the 1980s. Let's listen. My guest is Judith Tannenbaum. Her book is Disguised as a Poem, My Years Teaching Poetry at San Quentin. She joins us by telephone from the San Francisco Bay Area. You were really walking a tightrope this whole time because obviously when you're in an environment like this and you're a woman, and you're interfacing with prisoners, there are lots of issues, there are lots of rules. Let's talk about some of this, as well as some of these guys that you got to know so well. Guys like Elmo and Spoon.
Right. There are a lot of things in there. What you're talking about, the tightrope, was definitely like a predominant image for my experience walking this tightrope. And the tightrope was between, constantly between these opposing paradoxical realities. As I say in the book, I mean, at Quentin, the book describes a lot of the paradox, and there's an image at Quentin that hits somebody coming in from the outside the very first second, because when you've walked through the third gate, the last gate, and you're finally into what's considered the prison, through that last gate, you walk onto a plaza, and on the right-hand side are all the chapels, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, you know, chapels, and on the left-hand side, you can see the top of Death Row.
Hmm.
So that's what you walk between when you're walking inside the prison, the chapels and Death Row. And that image just holds, it speaks so profoundly of certainly my experience there, how to walk between these dramatically and intensely opposite poles of existence. And in terms of the specific question you asked me, I mean, there's a rule in prison, one of them, I mean, that's written down, the rule on familiarity, that a staff person, I wasn't a staff person, I was what they call a free person, but I was working there, so, because I was paid for from outside grants, but that it's a rule against over-familiarity, so that you're not supposed to be friends and with inmates. You're not supposed to become too familiar, let them know too much about you. And, you know, I can understand a prison logic for that rule, because I'm sure there's experience that, you know, if a prisoner knows a lot about somebody on staff, they can use that information to manipulate the staff person. So I can kind of understand that. But at the same time, it's one of those rules that, you know, applies to everybody when the reality doesn't apply to everybody. And also, it made it very hard to do my job, because, of course, if you're teaching poetry, you have to be familiar.
There's a certain intimacy to poetry, is there not?
Exactly, exactly. And as my students definitely, you know, made sure that I acknowledged, if I was asking them to be open in their poems, I had to be willing to be open myself. I mean, otherwise, it's exploitation in some sense. So walking that tightrope was one of the most difficult. And you mentioned Elmo. And Elmo was, as I describe in the book, I mean, he was my primary teacher in a lot of ways at Quentin, because he's an extremely bright, articulate human being. And he's also very righteous in a good way, in the sense of making sure that he and people around him are honest about ourselves. So he would never let me off the hook if I was falling too far to one side of that tight, you know, that balancing act. He would let me know, and I think all my students probably would say that I erred too much in the direction of following the rule about overfamiliarity. But I feel that I did the absolute best job I could in walking that tightrope. I'm going to read, if I could, do I have time to read the whole of one poem?
Sure.
Okay. This is a poem of Elmo's that I think describes a lot of what we're talking about. And the poem, his poem is called Disguised as a Poem, and then he let me use this poem. The title of his poem is the title of my book.
And you close the book with it.
I close the book with it, exactly. In Birkenstocks and handcrafted earrings, still living a life from the 60s, you enter this place, this dungeon, this dust bowl on the edge of the bay, where 3,000 men wait for the sweet rain called freedom. You walk a path from the front gate across the garden plaza. Your pale feet step softly upon the spots where angry men have died. Don't let the pink and yellow roses fool you. This is not a pretty place. Two flights down, you wait for us to come, bearing the fruits and scars of our embattled lives, disguised as poems, scrawled on bits of paper last week in a cell when sleep was hard to find. For 3 hours in that basement room, we are cut off, a million miles away from your daughter and your cat, 100 yards from Death Row. For 3 hours we joust, we orbit around each other, wrestling with words. We make love with words. We grow close. We meet in a place called poetry, one woman and a few captured men. We speak of poems and grasp at them like straws, until it is time to go. Two flights up, the cool night air greets us. There are always those few tight minutes waiting for count to clear and the inevitable parting of ways. We could go have coffee and speak of poems all night, but your daughter will miss you, and I must be back in my cell before 10. It is always the same. For 3 hours, you or Favia or Sharon or Scoop manage to get close to me, only to be peeled away like the bark from a young tree, leaving behind a little spot, bare and vulnerable, that does not want to see you go, but will die of exposure long before you return.
Right.
That's a pretty, I think it's a fabulous poem and also a really excellent description of one of the paradoxes that the men have to deal with, how to open up and still...
And we have a society that wants these people to be punished, and the loneliness and the pain in that poem is quite palpable.
Yeah, exactly. I know. When you talk about like public response and stuff, and you know, there's so much kind of unthinking statements about, well, they shouldn't have this and they shouldn't have that because it's punishment. I mean, just the experience is punishment, you know. But I think that's only possible. I mean, thinking that way is only possible because of like what you said before, that in some way then we don't think of the men and women in prison as human beings, you know, because I don't think if we really thought of them as human beings, we could be so cavalier.
Yeah.
Elmo was, most of the time, when I knew him and everything, he was on what's called mainline, which is, you know, not locked up in a cell all the time, where you're able to, you know, you sleep in your cell, but then in the day you have a prison job, you can take classes. At that time, I taught at Clinton in the 80s, and there was a lot more going on in terms of programming. There's a lot less programming now. But there was... an eight-month period of the 4 years that I was at the prison, the time that I document in the book, in which Elmo was in what's called the hole, and that was a comparable situation. It was, you know, it wasn't as, Quentin's the oldest prison in California, so its architecture is very different than the new supermax prisons that are being built now. But at that time, Quentin was the maximum prison, security prison in the system. But the prisons that are built now, they're a person in supermax, it's not only locked in his cell 23 hours a day, he doesn't even see a person. Everything's done kind of through machines and stuff. But at that time, it was, I mean, at Quentin or even in the hole, like for Elmo, whoever was in the hole, it wasn't like that. It was still a cell block, and there were actual people, you know, bringing you your food and taking you to the shower and things like that. So it wasn't as horrific as things have gotten now. But yes, he did go through that experience, and that's one of the stories, you know, that's in the book, because I got permission to be able to visit him once a week, take him poems and read his poems and bring him books, you know, poetry books to read and things like that.
You even took him a poet up there.
I know, that was like a really amazing experience. The poet Frank Bidart, as I say, one of the big conversations we had was about point of view. And Frank Bidart, who's just a wonderful North American poet, he writes a lot of poems that are in persona. He has a long one in the voice of a woman named Ellen West, who died of anorexia. He has one in the voice of the dancer Nijinsky. And so, I had shared his work with my students. And he lived on the East Coast, but I read that he was coming to California, and so I actually wrote and asked if he would come in and be a guest. And he agreed to do that. But then when he was coming in, as you said, Elmo was in the hole, and Elmo was so articulate on the subject of point of view that I asked and got permission both from the prison staff and from Bidart, for Bidart to just come in and meet with Elmo in the hole. And it was... just an amazing thing, because the San Quentin cell blocks are five tiers, five stories long. They're concrete, they're stone, they're very noisy. And when we walked in, it was late summer, and there was a baseball game, and it seemed like most of the men in the unit were watching baseball games, and there was all these cheers and yells. That was the noise, and it was very echoey, dungeony kind of sound, echo system. And Bidart comes up, and Bidart stands on the outside, on the tier on the outside of the cell, on the bars, and Elmo's in his cell on his side of the bars, and the two men are having this conversation about poetry and how do they find time and silence and space, each of them, to be able to write. The dark, you know, Elmo talking about when it's in a cell like this, in a block where there's so much noise, he just has to stay up in the night to be able to write when it's quiet. And Bedard saying, yes, he has to do the same thing. He has to disconnect his phone. He has to just turn everything off in his apartment so that he can have the silence and focus he needs to write. And these two men having this conversation on either side of the bars, and then Bedard, and then Elmo kind of passing his copy of Bedard's poems in through the bars for Bedard to read, read from his poems to Bedard. I mean, it was just a very powerful situation, I mean, a thing to experience. These last lines of Bedard's poem, they're part of Bedard's poem, The War of Vaclav Nijinsky, that he read. He read, "Suffering has made me what I am. I must not regret or judge or struggle to escape it. There is a moral here about how long you must live with the consequences of a short action."
You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. 25 years ago, I did my only interview with Judith Tannenbaum, and this was quite an experience to hear what it was like to teach poetry in a maximum security prison. And we'll bring you our final segment of this conversation, but first, this message. You're listening to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. 25 years ago, I did my only interview with Judith Tannenbaum, and I thought a lot about what it must have been like to be inside a prison trying to write poetry as I listened to this interview. Let's close it out now on the Best of the Book Nook.
A moment ago, you said you were surprised by a question that people kept asking you. I would not have thought of that question to ask. My question, I think, would have been on the opposite end. How has this experience changed you, Judith Tannenbaum?
Right, that's a great question. And it's funny because, as I said to you, that's, you know, the other question about the change of the prisoners is the question I'm always asked. But then I did a reading to about 50 men at a prison in Michigan. And I did the same bookstore reading, and that was the question somebody asked me. How was I changed? Which is the relevant question, and the question, that the way the book addresses. And I was changed in a number of ways that, you know, probably most of them I can't even put simple words to. But one of them was certainly what I was indicating before, seeing people in much more extreme circumstances than I had ever really seen intimately in my life, asking questions about how do I live as a human being in this situation, and just the privilege, really, of getting to witness that and explore that in some ways together, share that. That made me go much deeper inside myself about what it is to be a person. The effort of what you were describing of walking the tightrope, that effort also made me go much, I had to become a much stronger person so that I didn't just fall to one side or the other and be a much more deeply, deeply honest person. I mean, those were all qualities I tried for, honesty and depth and all of that, but I mean, the experience made me have to ground myself a lot more. Because how to honor both parts of all these paradoxical demands that the situation, you know, implied or imposed, meant that I had to get bigger. And I think I did. So those are like big answers to that question big answers. But it also changed my life just in the very specific way of meeting some people who are now friends. I mean, I'm definitely friends, very close friends with Elmo and with Spoon and with Codis, who are three of the men who were primarily discussed in the book.
Are they still in
prison? They are still in prison. Mm-hmm. There are only one or two of my students who are out, one who didn't have a life sentence, one who's dead, was killed in prison, or two who didn't have life sentences, and then one who was killed in prison. But everybody else is still, I mean, the laws in California, what's happened in California with our past two governors is that a number of people like Elmo who have like a 7-to-life sentence or what's called a term-to-life sentence, when those sentences were given, they were meant to be sentences in which a person would eventually get out. And let's say when the 7-to-life sentence was given, the average time served on that sentence was 11 years. But our past two governors are unwilling to let anybody parole at all, virtually. So, for example, Elmo's already served almost 23 years.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, they're all still inside. But they are actually just individual people who are now really part of my life, and so that's certainly a change as well.
It sounds like Spoon is particularly close to you.
Yeah, well, the time of the years that I was there, Spoon was in many ways, or a certain kind of closeness, we really shared more than with anybody else, because he's the only one maybe that question of change applies to, or at least he saw something about himself that he didn't know. When he first came to the class, the first year of class, he basically said nothing. He surrounded himself in a circle of chairs. He maybe showed me one or two poems. He was very quiet, but he was there every week. And then when I was able to come in on the grant and able to spend more time at the prison, I started having individual consultations with my students, and Spoon was the first one I met with. And he showed me about 50 poems that he had written in that year, and he didn't stop talking. And so he had no idea about this person in him that was the writer of poems. But as soon as he saw that person became in many ways his primary identity, and he became, people at the prison started calling him the poet. And so he really discovered some part of himself he didn't know existed. And for me, as a teacher, I mean, nothing's more profound than that for a teacher, where you're actually getting to witness the birth of somebody, you know, some part of somebody. So that made for a very, very profound connection between us. And he really, I mean, just listening to me talk about my ideas was kind of, it inspired him in some way. So that was such an easy thing. That was an easy thing for me to give. It wasn't something that made me have to walk that tightrope, you know? And so, yeah, we were very, very close. But I've become very close with Elmo if somebody reads the book, they'll know that Elmo was challenged me often and frequently, but also taught me so much. And so when I started writing the book, I asked Elmo if he would read it as I was writing it, because I knew he would kind of force me to be my most honest, truest self. And he's also a very good writer. And he did agree to do that. So in that process of writing back and forth about what I was writing, we became very, very close. And I consider him a really close friend at this point. So that's certainly a big way. And so, you know, now prison, I know prison much more intimately from, you know, the prisoner's point of view, so that, you know, that's probably changed me as well. So those are all parts of the answer to that question that you asked.
My guess is Judith Tannenbaum. Her book is disguised as a poem, My Years Teaching Poetry at San Quentin, recently published by Northeastern University Press. She joins us by telephone from the San Francisco Bay Area. Explain the connection to our listeners between Samuel Beckett, the playwright, and San Quentin. It's a very intriguing connection.
Yeah, and makes for one of the main stories in the book as well. In the late 1950s, when Godot was first being performed in this country, well, its first West Coast performances were done by the San Francisco Actors Workshop, and they did performances in San Francisco, but they also took in a performance or two. I don't remember the number, but they took in a performance, did a performance at San Quentin, and in 1957, and that audience, the prisoner audience, was like the only audience that really understood the play. And in fact, Martin Esslin, in his book about the Theater of the Absurd, has a chapter on Godot at Quentin, because it was so profound how the prisoners understood the play, because of course spoke a lot to the reality of their lives, and then so So Beckett had a strong feeling about Quentin and Godot. And then also there was a man who was in prison at that time in the 50s who was very moved by the production, started the San Francisco San Quentin theater group, and then he was paroled and he became friends with Beckett, Rick Clouchy. And so Beckett just had a very strong feeling about the connection between Quentin and Godot. Then there was a man, Jan Janssen, who is Swedish and who was directing Godot in the maximum security prison in Sweden in the mid-80s. Godot heard about that and wrote to Jan and told him how great, this is just where he wanted his work done, this is who he wanted to be performing his work. Jan and Beckett struck up a friendship, met, and then Beckett asked Jan to come to San Quentin and see if he could do a similar production in Quentin as he did in the maximum security prison in Sweden. Through a number of just real coincidental, fortuitous, you know, cosmic things, we were able to do this. And so Jan came and spent 6 months really working with a cast, Spoon being one of them. The silent Spoon ended up playing Paso and having to roar on stage. Mm. And so they had this 6 months really to rehearse and this production, which got a lot of attention. I mean, it was at the same time, or just before, there was a New York production of Godot that Robin Williams and F. Murray Abraham and Bill Irwin were all part of. And Bill Irwin was, a San Francisco guy, he lived in San Francisco, and he came out here. So he actually came in a few times to rehearsals and then to the performance, and F. Murray Abraham came to one of our performances. We were able over three nights to bring in 600 people from the outside to see these three performances, and it was quite, quite amazing. And then these men, I mean, like that the chapter or the story of Godot in my book, it ends with, I mean, the last night was a lot. The last performance was, we had a lot of people from the media there, and the cast was getting just so much praise, and it was just beautiful. And then at the very end, I mean, it's time for the performance to be, for the men to go back to their cells, and the audience leaves and the men are strip searched, you know, before being sent back to their cells. So
it's almost like a part of the play,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly.
Judith, it's really been a treat to read your book. I have never known anyone who was in prison. I did write someone in prison who I didn't know one time because I had heard that this fellow was in there and that it was what you call a bum rap. And I wrote him and he wrote me back, and we didn't correspond for very long, but it was a pretty powerful experience, just that brief experience, right. And I feel guilty that I haven't done that more.
Most of my students have told me that their writing started by writing letters, and because just what you said, I mean, letters are the one way that they can be assured of for connection with people, and so their capacities, their interests, their recognition of the power of writing almost always starts with writing letters.
You also make the point in the book, first of all, that they kept trying to call you a hippie, but you describe yourself as a radical, and you really didn't think that you fitted in very well into the typical employee of a San Quentin prison. Not that you were actually employed by the prison, but you were working there. And you'd made some discoveries, didn't you, about some of your coworkers there, that they weren't quite as monolithic in their viewpoints as you might have imagined.
Right. I mean, and I'm glad you raised that, because that certainly was another part of how did I change when I went there. I mean, I was a Berkeley 60s person. I mean, as Elmo said in that poem, I'm walking in with my Birkenstocks, And and I had very, predictable Berkeley 60s Birkenstock assumptions about who a guard would be and who somebody who'd worked his whole life in prison would be. And I had more assumptions. I mean, I was ignorant. I was completely ignorant. I mean, I had no personal experience about prison at all. But I probably had more monolithic assumptions regarding staff than I did about prisoners. I was more open to accepting the humanity of prisoners than I was staff. But But working there, especially when I was on there on the grant for the 3 years, and so was really working there, was basically there full time. Right, my assumptions had a breakdown, and see that just like in any group of people, this is a group of people, and they were very, very different people. And some, there was an associate warden, for example, I came to respect enormously, and he did a job that I can't imagine any radical doing. I mean, the way that he walked that tightrope and always managed to come out on the side of fairness to inmates, I mean, was pretty amazing to me. And so I had to, I was glad to open my eyes on, in that way. And then another kind of incident that I describe in the book was, there was a report written that was circulating, basically analyzing the future of prison, and it was written, it came out of an organization called National Council on Crime and Delinquency, and so many of its statements and conclusions were exactly what I believed in, and staff was being asked to address this publication, and they were agreeing with it too, and that just like so, it shocked me so much. So then I started having different conversations with staff, and instead of asking the questions, what would you do about this or that, just asking questions about descriptions of what we each saw. And when we talked in that way, not going to the action or the conclusion, but just descriptions of what existed, there was so much more agreement. And that was very, when we did go to conclusions, there were differences, but it was very encouraging to me to see that there was this place, actually, where we were seeing things similarly. And if we could, I had more belief then that there was a possibility of coming up with different conclusions if we could start more from the place that we saw similarly. But, of course, in the past, 15 years, what's happened in California prisons and has gone in a very opposite direction. And
so much for that report, huh?
Not just that report. And one of the things that we deal with in California is that our prison guards union has phenomenal political power in this state. So even though I would still say that as a group, it's composed of individuals, and individuals are really, really different. And some, I respect and trust. I'm very concerned about the power of the CCPOA.
Well, Judith, we really appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us here in the Book Nook.
Oh, I thank you so very much. It's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you very much.
And that was the late Judith Tannenbaum, recorded 25 years ago, talking about her book, Disguise as a Poem, My Years Teaching Poetry at San Quentin. She's born on February 13th, 1947. She died December 5th, 2019. She chose to end her own life. She was in a lot of pain. In 2010, she published a book with Spoon Jackson. She talked about Spoon a lot during that conversation. It was a double memoir called By Heart, Prison and Two Lives. And when Judith decided to end her own life, she did it through the Final Exit Network. And she wrote at the time, quote, "The image I keep seeing is a fallen redwood tree. Its apparently dead trunk, teeming with life, lichen, insects, and so much more." For the Best of the Book Nook, remembering Judith Tannenbaum. And I'd like to also share a remembrance of someone else who was a part of my life at one time. I just heard that Gail Lichtenfels of Yellow Springs died. And Gail, when I first came to Yellow Springs in 1993, there were two bookstores right on Xenia Avenue downtown. And Gail had the Epic Bookshop on one side of the street. And on the other side, Mary Alice Wilson had Dark Star, which is still there. Her daughter's running it now. Mary Alice passed away some years ago. And Gail died recently, and she was an amazing bookseller. I remember going in there, into that Epic in 1993. It was a beautiful space. Her longtime associate, the late Eddie Eckenrode, was also a key figure in that bookstore. And she was a curator of books, beautiful books and greeting cards, and just a wonderful space. You walked in there, and they had usually ambient kind of New Age music going. And then upstairs, a beautiful space for events. And about 30 years ago, she asked me if I would give a talk in their space up there. And it was a wonderful experience. Someone actually filmed it. I watched the film recently, and I thought, who is that young guy? But it was just a lovely space, and I appreciated her so much. And she moved the Epic around. It was in several locations, and it changed. The vibe changed in the bookstore, but she still stayed devoted to her mission of bringing books to readers. And she was a good one. And so was Mary Alice Wilson over at Dark Star. A very different kind of store. Still there. Lots of comic books, lots of used books. Just an amazing inventory. And Yellow Springs supported two really beautiful bookstores. And there have been others as well over the years. But those are some of my memories of moving to town here in 1993 and walking into the Epic. And Eddie would quite often be there at the desk. And I had an apartment. Eddie Eckenrode was another amazing Yellow Springs personality. I had an apartment above the hardware store when I first came to town. And Eddie also had an apartment up there. And I knew him as the guy that worked at the bookshop, the Epic, and he played the mellow, very ambient New Age music when you'd walk in there. And I didn't realize that he had an apartment in the same building where I was living until I started noticing over the lunch hour, if I was back at my apartment, I would hear really loud punk music blasting out of this apartment across the hallway. And then one day I saw the door open, and here comes Eddie walking out of the door, the same guy who played this really mellow, relaxing music over at the bookshop. And I figured out years later that he was an artist. He was in there painting, making paintings. And this was the music that he painted by, this just loud, incredibly noisy punk music. And I just thought, wow, who knew? What a world. So I remembered Eddie in this remembrance, along with Mary Alice and Gail Lichtenfels, who passed away just recently here in Yellow Springs. And for those of you who have shopped for books in Yellow Springs over the years, I'm sure you are remembering those shops when they were running back in the 1990s. The Epic, just this beautiful space, and Gail with her curated collection. Whenever I needed a really nice greeting card, I would go into the Epic because they just had an incredible variety. They had incense. It was so Yellow Springs. Of course, so is Dark Star. And for bookshops everywhere, these memories, they never go away, do they? They just they stick with us. And like I say, Gail moved around. She had shops on other locations, Dayton Street, the other side of Xenia. And they were different. They had a different vibe to them. But just, I really appreciated her beautiful eye for maintaining a bookshop, and very kind, asking me to speak there on that one occasion. For the Best of the Book Nook, remembering Gail Lichtenfels, Mary Alice Wilson, Eddie Eckenrode, and Judith Tannenbaum. Thanks for listening to your public radio station. We have over 1,200 interviews archived at wyso.org. You can listen to them whenever you feel like it. Or they're also on YouTube. Just look up our YouTube channel, WYSO on YouTube, and you can listen to them there as well. And I wasn't aware of this until recently. I just accidentally saw a Google link pop up for my name with YouTube. And I was like, what? I'm on YouTube? How cool is that? For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. Thanks for listening.